A top NATO official says that the Western military alliance is no longer bound by past commitments to hold back from having robust posture in Eastern Europe. Iran strongly condemns that the segregation of Al-Aqsa Mosque by, quote, racist Zionists, urging the world to counter the apartheid regime of Israel. Two more Turkish soldiers are killed in northern Iraq as Ankara is pushing ahead with offensive against Kurdish militants near its borders. Hello and welcome to World News, broadcast from our Tehran studios with me, Behruz Najafi. NATO says it's no longer bound by past commitments to hold back from deploying its forces to Eastern Europe. The alliance's deputy secretary general says that Russia's decisions to attack Ukraine and halt dialogue with NATO show it has effectively moved away from the terms of a 1997 agreement between the alliance and Moscow. Under that agreement, the two sides agreed to work to prevent any potentially threatening buildup of conventional forces in Central and Eastern Europe. Mircea Giovanna said that the alliance now has no restrictions to have robust presence in the eastern flank to ensure its territory is protected. It did not give details of any planned deployment, though. NATO sent some troops to the Baltic states and Poland in 2017. It also sent reinforcements there following Russia's operation in Ukraine. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says that Moscow is pursuing what he calls the liberation of Ukraine's Donbass as an unconditional priority. Lavrov says that other Ukrainian territories should decide about their future on their own. The comments came after Russia intensified its shelling to seize Severodonetsk, which is the largest city under Ukraine control in Donbass. Russian forces are trying now to encircle the key city. They also destroyed command posts and missile strikes on two towns near Severodonetsk on Sunday. The Russian military said earlier that they captured the nearby city of Lyman, though that account was challenged by Ukrainian officials. Russia is now focusing on seizing the entire eastern Ukrainian regions of Donetsk and Lugansk. Moscow says it wants to protect the local pro-Russia population there. Meantime, the European Commission remains divided over imposing a total ban on Russian oil imports over its war in Ukraine. The issue has become a bone of contention ahead of the bloc summit this week. We've discussed that further in our news review program a short time ago.
It's time now for our news review segment, where we look deeper into one of our stories. EU member states have failed to agree on an embargo on Russia's oil imports over its war in Ukraine. Senior EU diplomats were deadlocked weeks after the European Commission president proposed a complete ban on Russian oil by imports by the end of the year. Sources say diplomats will still try to discuss a compromise plan ahead of the bloc summit on an exemption for pipeline deliveries to landlocked European countries. Hungary, Slovakia and the Czech Republic say an oil embargo would be a severe blow to their economies. Meanwhile, a senior EU diplomat said there was still too much detail to sort out before EU leaders summit in Brussels on Monday. In the meantime, the German economy minister expressed fears that the EU's unity was, quote, starting to crumble ahead of the summit. Joining us is Mike Harris, the editor at Veterans Today from Phoenix, and also Tony Gosling, historian and investigative journalist from Bristol in the UK. Gentlemen, welcome. Mike, if I start with you, so we have several EU nations saying a Russian oil ban will essentially crush their economies. Experts have come out and said the same for all EU countries. Is Europe punishing itself here?
Well, what you're seeing here really is you have governments who are loyal to the globalist interest that want to see Russia destroyed, and you have other governments within the EU who are loyal to their populations and to the people who put them in office. So what you're seeing is a power struggle within the EU of the globalist interest versus the populist interest. And, you know, the governments who want to do the best for their own people, for their own populations. They want to preserve their economy. They want to make sure that people have heating oil in the wintertime, that they have fuel in the summertime, that they don't do without, that they don't damage their own livelihoods, that their own lifestyle doesn't suffer because of the globalists trying to take down and punish Russia. So that's really as simple as I can make it right there as to what's really going on with this disagreement about the oil. It's really backfired and it has hurt the West. It's raising fuel prices, no grain exports, no fertilizer exports. All of these things have been disastrous to the Western economies. Even here in the U.S., we feel it. We're paying outrageously high prices for gasoline and diesel fuel and all these products, and food is starting to get scarce. And so you're finding out which governments are doing the job that they're put in office to do to protect their people, and which governments are truly aligned with the globalists and the elites who wish to destroy and have become toxic to their own populations.
Just bear with me, Mike, just bear with us for a moment while we take a look at some social media reactions to this story. First comment is from Peter, who says the US puppet project EU can't fall apart soon enough. It's already caused the great suffering to ordinary people. WTI Trading Group has posted whether or not the oil market will like such a watered down embargo remains to be seen. Pundits will have to lower their voices of supply fears as Russia can find buyers in Asia to compensate for the market share lost in the EU. Macro says the EU knows very well they can't enforce an embargo as Russia will divert oil to other nations. Such oil embargo politics will only boost the oil price. Steve says brainless leaders of the EU with their senseless sanctions against Russia have successfully started the process of Europe's destruction. Many of the sanctions against Russia, especially the oil and gas embargo, truly hurts Europe, but not Russia. How long will Europeans tolerate this? Tony's final thoughts on this. Tony, there's another post that says Russia can find alternative buyers in Asia to compensate for the market share lost in the European Union. I mean, and that's been a subject of debate for a while now. Is this EU measure even a punitive measure against Russia?
Well, no. And in fact, Ursula von der Leyen herself has been saying over the last few days I will paraphrase her, to save Europe from Vladimir Putin, we must continue to buy Russian oil, which is an almost ridiculous, humorous thing for her to say, because she's understood that the world oil price will go up and that will benefit Putin. And therefore, but of course, what she's doing, she's just making excuses for the fact that her embargo is a complete failure. And the way I think that the EU is operating here is it's coming up with its own policy that a few powerful people have drawn up on the back of a packet of cigarettes, and then they're then imposing that and announcing it through the media to the world. And then any governments that start to push back and resist and say, no, we're not doing that, the EU is trying to use these kind of mafia-like intimidation tactics through very hardball diplomacy to try and bully them into agreeing with the policy that they've come up with in the first place. So I think that's really what we're seeing here is a kind of the reason why Britain actually left the European Union is because they're just trying to push people around, and everyone is starting to rumble their game. There's also this embarrassing issue of the Ukrainian Nazis. I noticed one of the British newspaper foreign editors was over in Ukraine over the last few days, has just returned, Steve Sweeney. And he's called the failure of the Western media to really acknowledge that these are genuine Nazis that are fighting with the Ukrainian army as part of the army as a masterclass in fascism denial. So they only, the really people who are really culpable in the West are those who are turning a blind eye to this fascism and the top-down European Union attempts to impose these ridiculous policies and to do a sort of recursive version of what Hitler was trying to do, which is attack the Russians, and even Napoleon attacked the Russians, and this Russophobia. And I think we just need to get rid of it right now, because it could easily get out of hand in Ukraine if NATO starts to get its oar in there. So, I mean, I think that's really where we're coming from, is a complete denial of the fascist aspects of the Western support for the Ukrainian cause, so-called cause, which has been to attack the breakaway republics for the last 8 years, killing 15,000 people in the southeast of Ukraine, a fact which is not acknowledged at all here in the Western press.
Gentlemen, thank you very much indeed. Let me thank our guests for their contribution. Mike Harris is the editor at Veterans Today, joining us from Phoenix, and Tony Gosling is a historian and investigative journalist, joining us from the British city of Bristol. That brings an end to another edition of the News Review.
Welcome back. Moving on, Iran has condemned Israeli forces' desecration of Al-Aqsa Mosque and attacks on Palestinians there. Foreign Ministry spokesman has warned against Tel Aviv's latest adventurism and provocative moves. Said Khatibzadeh praised Palestinian people's resistance against the regime and recalled the Palestinian cause as the top priority of the Muslim world. He said all freedom-seeking people around the world, especially the people and governments of Muslim nations, have a duty to join hands to wholeheartedly defend Al-Quds and to stand up to the apartheid Israeli regime. The spokesman also called on the international community and organizations to fulfill their legal responsibility by stopping Israeli atrocities against Palestinians. A Palestinian rights group has accused Israel of war crimes over its shelling of a warehouse in Gaza during its attack on the Strip last year. A study by the group Al-Haq says that the Israeli shelling ignited hundreds of tons of chemicals in the warehouse in the northern Gaza town of Beit Lahia, even though no fighting was going on nearby. The report quotes residents as saying that they suffered from diarrhea, vomiting, and intense stomach pain after the attack. Al-Haq says that the attack deliberately targeted civilian economic and industrial infrastructure in Gaza. The Beit Lahia warehouse is the largest of its kind in the Gaza Strip. Al-Haq says that in the days after the shelling, Israeli forces shelled at least six other Palestinian plants. The group is the leading group providing information to the International Criminal Court in The Hague on alleged Israeli war crimes and crimes against humanity. Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi has praised the Iraqi parliament's recent decision that criminalizes any form of normalization with the Tel Aviv regime. He made the comments in a phone call with Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi. The Iraqi premier said his government and parliament have outlined a number of measures to support Palestinians and their cause. He underlined that Israel-Palestine is not just restricted to Muslims, but to all who seek justice in the world. On Thursday, the Iraqi parliament unanimously approved legislation making it illegal to have any kind of relations with Israel. And that at a time when some Arab countries have formally established ties with the Israeli regime, despite opposition both at home and abroad. No to normalization, the Iraqi lawmakers' move to criminalize ties with Israel has sparked a wave of reactions on social media. Hashtag Trending has conducted a review.
Many see the normalization of relations between certain Arab states and Israel a scheme designed to meet the needs of Tel Aviv, but not all Arab states are falling for such a scheme. Hey everyone, Ali Reza here, back with another edition of Hashtag Trending, and this is the story that we're looking at today through the lens of social media. Iraq's parliament has passed a law making it illegal for the country to ever normalize relations with the Israeli regime. The parliament said in a statement that this legislation is, quote, a true reflection of the will of the people. Many have taken to social media to welcome the votes by the Iraqi lawmakers. They say that this legislation is a victory not only for the Iraqis, but also for the Palestinians and the Arab and Islamic nations. Let's read our first tweet of the day coming from Jihad Muhammad. The Iraqi parliament passed a law criminalizing normalization with the Zionist entity, a clear victory for Palestine, Iraq, and the Arab and Islamic nations, and a halt to the state of collapse in the nation. Treasonous normalization. Muhammad said that this is the second parliament in the Arab world to criminalize normalization with Israel since the so-called Abraham Accords after Kuwait. Abir said the Iraqi parliament passes law banning normalization with apartheid Israel. This region is still capable of providing a tiny sense of sanity and hope. HSD has our next tweet. History will remember those Arab rulers who fell on their faces whilst bowing down to the tyranny of Zionism. Iraq rejects any normalization with the Zionist entity. The law comes amid widespread reports pointing to the Kurdistan region's cooperation with the Israeli spy agency Mossad. Now calls are growing on other parliaments in Arab and Islamic nations to ban any acts of normalizing relations with apartheid Israel. Moving on with our tweets, Khadija Soulmate said, "We highly appreciate Iraq Parliament for voting unanimously on the law criminalizing normalization with Israeli apartheid regime. We call on all parliaments to criminalize any form of contact with the Israeli occupation people." Palestinian resistance groups, along with Lebanon's Hezbollah, have praised the new law passed by the Iraqi Parliament as a decisive and historic move that expresses support for the Palestinian cause. They also say that this new vote has blocked all infiltration corridors for the Zionist enemy. Well, that's a wrap for another hashtag trending. Many thanks.
Now moving on, two more Turkish soldiers have been killed in northern Iraq, and this while Ankara is pushing its latest military operation against Kurdish militants near its borders. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Close up, Iran.
Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Buildings have collapsed. Watching stuff like war and bloodshed makes me nervous. I better turn off the television. Nothing's more horrible than war, and of course, peace is one of the most beautiful words ever created. By the way, did you know that we have a Museum of Peace in Tehran? Taking a tour to this museum would be a good idea for today. Yes, why not? Stay with me. The idea of founding Tehran Peace Museum took shape following talks between the founders of the Tehran-based Society for Chemical Weapons Victims Support, SCWVS, and a coordinator for the International Network of Museums for Peace in 2005. The founders of Tehran's Peace Museum came to the conclusion that the suffering of Iranian people, which were caused by the enemy's chemical weapons, is a good reason for exhibiting the consequences of war and violence. Tehran Peace Museum was temporarily closed for public visitors in 2010 for redesign, and the new building with a completely new design was inaugurated in a ceremony in June 2011, attended by guests from different countries, including director of Hiroshima Peace Memorial Museum. Tehran Peace Museum has several features, such as it is the member of the International Network of Peace Museums. Its active members, particularly the museum guides, are the victims of war and chemical weapons. Tehran Peace Museum is linked to other peace museums around the world. Tehran Peace Museum pursues the goal of promoting the culture of peace. I am now in front of the entrance gate of Tehran Peace Museum, which is located at Park Shahr. Just beside me, there is a statue of a dove that is drinking water from inside a combat helmet. You know, dove is the symbol of peace, and this statue beautifully shows the significance of peace. Next to this statue, there is another statue which has the shape of the word sol, literally peace, with the beautiful Nastaliq-style calligraphy, and just above it, a dove flying. The color of this artistic craft is white, reminiscent of peace and calm and tranquility. So, let's go inside the museum to see what's exactly there. I am now in a big hall. In this hall, there are the busts of the world famous people who have done something for peace. There is a writing explaining everyone's life and efforts just beside each of the busts. This is the bust of Henri Dunant, founder of the International Red Cross. Just beside this bust, we have the bust of Mahatma Gandhi. And here, there is a television which shows a movie about the first charter of human rights in the world, namely the Cyrus Charter. And just below the television, there is a version of the clay cylinder of the Cyrus Charter on which is written a declaration in cuneiform script. Oh, look at here. The bust of Adolf Hitler. You know, Tehran Peace Museum also reminds us of those who jeopardized world peace and security and caused human suffering. Hitler is one of those savages. Oh my God! In this part of the museum, there is the statue of Zahak, the snake shoulder. According to Iranian mythology, Zahak was an oppressor who was bound into the walls of a cavern on Mount Damavand by a person called Fereydun. This statue also represents Zahak being tied. Of course, we cannot discuss the spectacles of this museum in a brief radio program. But if you happen to take a trip to Tehran, make sure to visit this museum. The online display of this museum is also available for enthusiasts.
Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Israel has gone ahead with a so-called Flag Day, yet the celebration is based on the false premise that Israel has a land of its own, which legally it does not. It's occupying Palestine. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at the significance of Israel Flag March Day, why it is so controversial, especially when it comes to Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and why Palestinians are rising up against the Israeli regime, by some accounts, more than ever before. First, let's find out the latest as to what transpired there on the ground. Mona Kandil is a correspondent who joins us from occupied Ramallah. Why don't we understand that before and during this so-called Flag Day, there were some scuffles, skirmishes, and there were some Palestinians that were arrested. What do you have for us? What happened?
Well, yes, the march, or the what's known as the Flag March, was supposed to take place in the afternoon hours. However, Israeli settlers in groups, let's say from 40 to 50 Israeli settlers, have raided the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex in the early hours of Sunday, escorted and protected by Israeli police, of course, have raided the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex and clashed with the Palestinian worshippers who had been in the Al-Aqsa Mosque and its complex in an attempt to prevent settlers from storming the Muslim holy site. This led to Israeli forces attacking the Palestinians, firing heavy tear gas, arresting a number of people. According to Palestinian paramedics in the city of Al-Quds, some 50 Palestinians were wounded in the early hours of Sunday. Dozens had been arrested by the Israeli forces as well. This had forced the Israeli troops to force out the Palestinian worshippers from the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex in order to allow the settlers to raid the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex. All the gates leading to the Al-Aqsa Mosque and its complex, the gates leading to the old town of Al-Quds, had completely closed by the Israeli forces. only the residents of the old town of Al-Quds and the Muslim quarter of Al-Quds were allowed to enter these areas. Other Palestinians from Al-Quds itself were not allowed to enter the Al-Aqsa Mosque or the old town of Al-Quds. As the footage were clear, we are speaking about some tens of thousands of Israeli settlers have marched today in Al-Quds and the old town of Al-Quds. Thousands others, however, unfortunately, have marched through the Muslim quarter of the city. Clashes have taken place. A number of Palestinians had been also wounded. The Israeli settlers were waving the Israeli flags in a very provocative move and in a challenging move. But we can say that the settlers have reached the Bab al-Amud area, the Damascus Gate. It's one of the gates leading to the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex. However, they were not allowed to enter the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex as they were thinking or as they were planning previously. We have to mention that one of the Israeli extremist lawmakers, Ben-Gavir, have raided the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex, but in the early hours of Sunday, also former Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu also took part in this flag march and raided the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex in the early hours of Sunday as well.
Very well. Thank you very much. It's interesting you taking note of that ultra-nationalist opposition party, as it's called, Itamar Ben-Gavir, because we're going to ask our guests about that. Monica Ndil, thank you. Of course, one of them from Occupied Ramallah. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of The Spotlight. Charlotte Cates from the Samadu and Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network joins us from Vancouver. Also joining us is Amal Wahdan, who's a Palestinian human rights advocate, who joins us from Occupy Ramallah.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Very well. Welcome to you both. Charlotte Cates, I'm going to start first with you, and let's get some idea from you as to why this so-called annual flag march is so controversial and so provocative, as it has been described, especially for the viewers who don't know exactly what is going on when it comes to the way that Palestinians feel like they're being, at a minimum, provoked by this.
Well, this is a blatantly fascist, racist march through occupied Jerusalem that is meant to declare Zionist sovereignty over the Palestinian capital, Jerusalem, which is also not only the capital of Palestine, but a revered holy site to Christian and Muslim Palestinians and to people around the world. And so this is an attempt to, with the full support and backing of the Zionist state, of the regime itself, with armed forces, armed guards, police and occupation soldiers to attack Palestinians, arrest them, lock them up on behalf of these fascists. It's really the display of an outright fascist hate march directed against the Palestinian people. And with the express and declared intention of seeking to destroy the holy sites of Palestinians and claim them for the occupation for eternity. And so obviously the Palestinian people, their resistance, their organizations, and their movements are standing against and rejecting what is a blatant fascist hate march throughout occupied Jerusalem. And that's why Palestinians everywhere are standing up against this kind of fascist display.
Amal Wahdan, one of the things that stood out looking at some of the video footage of some of these what's called extremists, Israeli settlers, which I'd like to find out from you what that term exactly means. But one of the things that was very noticeable, just looking at the footage that was being played, is the fact that there were so many of them that were so young. They looked like they were in their teens. I'm wondering what kind of information they have been fed when it comes to the occupation, when it comes to what is going on with Al-Quds, for example, or many other facets of why there is a crisis, given the age that is witnessed in some of these people who are marking, or Israelis who are marking this. And tell us why they are called extremist settlers.
Today it was a real battleground in Jerusalem between the owners of the land, the indigenous people of the land of Palestine, and these colonial settlers who were trying to prove, to prove that Jerusalem, United Jerusalem, is their eternal capital. The Palestinians have shown the world today, once again, that they are united not only in Jerusalem and the Old City and Al-Aqsa Mosque, but in all of Palestine and internationally in other capitals of the world where people raise the Palestinian flag as a sign of the unity of Palestinians and the unity of the homeland as well. These settlers try to show that they have the upper hand, and Bennett and his government, his extremist racist government, and the whole apartheid regime in this state were trying to raise to gain more politically out of these flag march in Jerusalem. At the beginning, it was on the scores of settlers who were marching towards Damascus gate, but later on, more and more settlers, racist settlers, and I have to say these are the most fascist Zionist settlers in Palestine, in occupied Palestine. But they've been seeing lots of confrontations since the early morning in Al-Aqsa Mosque, where Palestinians were defending their sacred holy places. And along the day, we have seen lots of clashes inside Jerusalem and the Old City and in other parts of the West Bank. There is over 100 people were injured by rubber bullets and by tear gas bombs.
Right.
And in Jerusalem, in Al-Zahra Gate, a big demonstration with the Palestinian flag was blocking the road in front of thousands of Israeli soldiers.
Sure.
And border guards who were trying to stop the demonstration from progressing. But they blocked it with big trash bins. And the soldiers couldn't get into the street until later today.
Well, since you mentioned that, Charlotte Case, there needs to be a note made here about how when the Palestinians are protesting, waving their flags, they are forbidden to do so, and the media portrays them, of course, through the eyes and mouths of the officials, that they are terrorists, and they're the ones that are creating or the cause of the violence. And yet when you have these extremist settlers, whom I understand, for example, this one particular leader, Itamar Ben-Gvir, the leader of a small ultra-nationalist opposition party who entered the compound early on Sunday along with dozens of supporters, yet they're okay. They're being escorted by security forces, but they are all right, and they're the ones who obviously, as they say, have a claim and have a right on this. Two different narratives there.
Yes, well, when you look at people like Ben Gvir, you look at these fascist forces, the reality is that these aren't just individuals. These aren't just a few extremists that don't represent the reality of Zionist politics today. In reality, Ben Gvir and his ilk are the face of the Bennett government. They are the face of the Israeli regime. They are being protected and supported by armed forces, by the border police. When Ben Gvir and his fascist hordes want to invade Al-Aqsa, the result is that dozens of Palestinians are tear gassed, shot with rubber bullets, or thrown in occupation prisons as a result of their fascist attacks, while those fascists are protected by the armed force of the state. So it's very clear that what we're seeing once again is that as the so-called coalition government is failing inside the Zionist project itself, that there's an attempt to externalize their contradictions and their problems by placing Palestinians by Palestinian land, Palestinian holy sites, and the Palestinian people atop everything else as kind of the target of all of these fascist forces. It really indicates just how openly fascist, openly genocidal, openly propagating terror against civilians the Israeli occupation state is. I mean, this is something that when we look at things like the assassination of journalists like Shireen Abu Akla, the attack on Palestinians carrying her coffin in a funeral, this is no different in reality, whether it's carried out by a so-called extremist waving the flag of the occupation settler state or an armed member of the occupation forces wearing that flag as a patch on his arm. The reality is this is a reflective of the full-scale fascistization of the occupation regime, and that while we see European countries like Germany that like to proclaim themselves defenders of human rights and opponents to fascism who have learned from the bloody history of Nazi Germany, what we're seeing instead is that they're following in the path of the Zionist regime in terms of arresting people inside their capital, Berlin, for carrying Palestinian flags and commemorating the Nakba. And this is why it is so great that we do see people everywhere around the world, particularly Palestinians in exile and diaspora, but people everywhere raising the Palestinian flag today to make it clear that this so-called march of flags of these fascists is not something that will prevail, not in Al-Aqsa, not in Jerusalem, and not anywhere else in the world.
Something that is understood widely, and I'd like to ask you, Amal Wahdan, about it, is that isn't it true that Jewish worship is actually not permitted at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound based on Israeli law? Isn't that the case, and that it's also forbidden, for example, for the chief rabbinate of Israel to not do that? And at the same time, we're seeing how these fascist or right-wing Israelis, they believe that they should be able to pray at the Al-Aqsa compound or inside the mosque. But that's an effort that's backed by the ruling coalition at this point and previous ones in order to change the status quo. Is that the case, these facts?
Of course, after the U.S. under Trump moved its embassy to Jerusalem, the settler movement, the Zionist settlers movement, have gained momentum. And they thought that if the U.S. now opened the gate for them to announce Jerusalem as their united eternal capital, they have a free hand to do everything, including splitting the place and time, as we say it, of Al-Aqsa Mosque, following the case of the Ebrahimi Mosque in Hebron. But the Palestinians are trying to prevent this by any price and with all the means that they have since the morning. And we witnessed that during the month of Ramadan, this battle has been going on and on. And these Zionists, racist settlers, are covered, actually, by Bennett and his party and by other right-wing and radical Zionists in the government and outside the government. As we mentioned before, there's about 63 Zionist organizations who are eagerly working to continue digging beneath the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and there were threats actually a few days ago that they want to demolish Al-Aqsa Mosque. So they are trying over and over again and they are blessed by their government and by the USA, to prove that this is a religious war. While on the ground, this is not a religious war. Palestinians in Palestine with and their different religions were living side by side, never had any problems before. But when they started, when the Zionist movement started to politicize religion, the slogan of religion was raised again by the Zionist terrorist movement before 1948 and afterwards. Now they are, because they are losing grip and they are losing the battle in all of Palestine, which is united now as a homeland and as a people, after they lose their grip, they wanted to turn the whole thing upside down and portray it as a religious war. And we are aware of this, and we won't let it go this far. We will prevent these settlers from changing the status quo in Jerusalem and in Al-Aqsa Mosque, and hopefully, with this unity that we've seen today and in the past months, we're going to succeed to prevent these racists, these Zionist racists, and this apartheid regime to continue doing what they have learned from the fascists and from the Nazis decades ago.
Well, Charlotte Cato, I guess there talks about how Palestinians' resistance has actually increased, to say the least. Of course, we could talk about the way that the Palestinian cause is highlighted ever more when it comes to social media, for example, and just the awareness. And taking a look at and doing a fact check here, as Palestinians, for example, commemorated the 74th anniversary of their forced displacement, the Nakba, we're looking at how not only is there a new spirit, and based on these facts, Palestinian attacks against Israelis to have increased at this point, resulting in the killing of 18. Not promoting death here, nor killing. I'm just looking at what is going on when it comes to Palestinians and how they're resisting. This number that I cited represents an unprecedented number since the Second Intifada, which ended in 2005, okay? So this is just one particular source. Do you see Palestinians rising up more than before when it comes to what has transpired, for example, in the past year?
Well, we are 1 year out from the anniversary of the Battle of Saif al-Quds, or the Unity Intifada, which was really a tremendous collective representation of the participation of the armed resistance and the participation of Palestinians at a popular level throughout occupied Palestine, from the river to the sea and everywhere in exile and diaspora, and even the sort of global camp of resistance and progressive forces everywhere in the world. And so this is why from Alid to Haifa to Ramallah to Gaza to Berlin and New York and Amsterdam, we see Palestinians marching and taking the streets to make it clear that Palestine is non-negotiable. And I think it's perhaps more clear than it has been in decades, is particularly since the beginning of the so-called Oslo Peace Project, that the demand of the Palestinian people and their resistance is the liberation of Palestine from the river to the sea, and that it's not acceptable to have a compromise with fascism, racism, and this Zionist project that is bent on the destruction of the Palestinian people. Instead, the resistance is growing, defending itself and defending the Palestinian people and their right to life and their right to exist and their right to survive and thrive throughout occupied Palestine. And that's why it is so important that people around the world, especially when Western governments are continuing to not only excuse the fascist behavior and practices of the occupation regime, but actually fund it and support it with arms and weapons and votes in the United Nations, that it's so important that we do everything we can to escalate the movement, to boycott and isolate the Zionist project, and that we do everything that we can to take to the streets and stop this ongoing imperialist Zionist project attacking the Palestinian people, and in to do this in support of the Palestinians and their resistance, which is growing stronger every day. And that's very obvious. The reality is that Bennett, his coalition, Ben-Gvir, these fascist forces are not engaging in these kinds of provocations and hate marches out of a sense of strength. They're engaging in these practices out of a sense of, you know, really fundamental fear and coming to grips with the reality that an artificially imposed settler colonial project inside occupied Palestine will never have a path to victory and security. The only path to security is the liberation of Palestine.
Final question, Amal Wahdan. One thing that is missing and has been missing for quite some time is the support that Palestinians need to have gotten from their respective Arab countries of the Persian Gulf, for example, Saudi Arabia. But we're looking at a certain countries like the UAE or like Bahrain who have formalized their ties in the so-called normalization with Israel. How much has that which has been accurately been viewed as a stab in the back of Palestinians. In 30 seconds, please.
Yes, well, it is a stab in the back, right? But at the end, the Palestinians took their cause in their own hands, and they know their strength, and they've have experienced this strength. The flag battle today that was manifested in Jerusalem was actually because our people in 1948 took into the street last year, and didn't the normalization of the Gulf states with Israel never stop the Palestinians from carrying their flag. Okay. Today, the flag was flying with a drone over Jerusalem. And is a defeat for the Zionist project in all of Palestine.
Thank you so much. I'm sorry to have jumped in. We're just fresh out of time. Amal Wahdan there, Palestinian human rights advocate. And thank you, Charlotte Cates, Sami Doun, Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, and Mona Kandil at the top of the hour from Occupied Ramallah. With that, we come to end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikova Tahwe, it's goodbye until next time.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, everyone. Welcome to IRB English Radio. This is Asma, your humble host for today's episode. And you're hearing me from Q&A on Islamic Belief, in which we shall discuss some very controversial issues. Well, without further ado, I would like to go directly into the main of discussion. But before that, I would like to introduce my guest. Welcome, brother.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you here. I'm so happy to meet you here again.
My pleasure.
So here with us, we have Dr. Karimi. And in this episode, we're going to discuss some debatable questions. So stay tuned. Today's question says that, does it mean that being related to the Prophet equals to being justified all the time? I mean, if you are related to the Prophet in a way that that person is his wife or the father of his wife, that means they're entirely true and whatever they say is going to be looked at something like truth.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. To have a very concise answer to this question, to be related to the Prophet in and of itself cannot prove that you are with the truth. Yes, it can be a privilege as long as you're going to take benefit from that. And this is the message that we can get from the Noble Book of Quran. Like, so we are not, I mean, talking against these people and for these people. The point is that being related to the Prophet in and of itself, it cannot be a sign, an indication to the rightfulness of those people, them being preferred over other people and so on and so forth. Now, the Quran in this regard says, talking about the son of a prophet, that is Prophet Nuh alayhi salam. We know that Prophet Nuh was very concerned about his son when the flood was coming. And we know that his son was a disbeliever. And seeing the concern of the Prophet Nuh, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala said that Laysa min ahlik. He is not a member of your family.
So we have also a proof in the Holy Quran.
Exactly. So biologically speaking, he is the son of the Prophet. Mm-hmm. But, I mean...
and he's been nurtured by him.
Exactly. But spiritually speaking, in the case of the Prophet and his wives and his fathers-in-law, we're talking about a relation through marriage. But here we're talking about relation through blood, blood relation, a father and a son.
Which is stronger.
Exactly, much stronger. But Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says that he's not a member of your family.
Mm-hmm. Meaning that though he's your son, he could not be considered a member of
point.
Your family.
So to be the son of Prophet Nuh is a great privilege as long as you are taking benefit from that. But if you're a disbeliever, you are worse than those people who do not have such
privilege. Yes, or
privilege.
You have to stay truthful to your father.
Exactly. So this is one indication from the Noble Book of Quran. When it comes to, spouses, again, we have a couple of examples from the Noble Book of Quran. We have the case of Pharaoh and his wife, Asiya, who was, a great lady, a virtuous lady. But the husband is such a, wicked person like Pharaoh.
Yes, a sinister.
Exactly. And the other is, as mentioned in the Quran, the wife of Prophet Lot, or Lut. Here we have a prophet, his wife is a disbeliever, according to the Noble Book of Quran, and she is punished later when the people of Lot are punished by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. When it comes to the Imam of the Ahlul Bayt, we have the example of Imam al-Hasan alayhi salam, our second Imam, and his wife who somehow murdered Imam al-Hasan alayhi salam.
He pointed she had a hand in his murder.
Exactly. And the same is true about Umm al-Fal, the wife of Imam al-Jabad alayhi salam. So the point is that this is the first point that I would like to share. This is the fact that these relations, such kind of relation in and of itself cannot prove anything. And we have very explicit examples in
so
this
So just
regard.
Being a family member doesn't mean that you are related to them.
That's the
or
point.
Or whatever you say is going to be taken as a truth.
Yeah, let me give you another example. The story of Prophet Lut is very famous. We know that some the people of Prophet Lut were famous for a very indecent action. And once when he had some guests who were actually the angels sent by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the people of Lot came to the Prophet and they wanted to commit the same action. And then addressing his people, Prophet Lut alayhi salam said that قَالَ هَؤُلَاءِ بَنَاتِ إِن كُنْتُمْ فَعَلِينَ chapter Hijr verse 71. He told the people that if you're looking for satisfying your sexual desires, then you can marry my girls. These are my daughters. You can marry them. Now, it has a very important message that sometimes a prophet like Prophet Lut alayhi salam, in order to prevent a very great sin, he is ready to permit his daughters to get married to some bad people.
Yes, exactly. That was the question I was going to ask you. Then why these prophets marry the wrong people?
It has so many reasons. When it comes to our Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family, I will explain about different reasons. Again, we do not mean that na'udhu billah, we attribute bad scenes
bad things,
to the
yes,
wives of the Prophet.
No.